From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
You're asking permission from your guest. Will you let me do something different? And I think, you know, to LA's diners' credit, they've really embraced it.
That's world-famous chef and TV personality Curtis Stone. Maude is his acclaimed Beverly Hills restaurant, known for its monthly rotating tasting menus built around a single ingredient. But at the end of 2017, Maude briefly closed its doors to retire the concept. Now they're back with a new focus, a series of quarterly menus inspired by four of the world's great wine regions. The first pour is Rioja. So we're not going to get to say, I'm really looking forward to basil, and wasn't pomegranate so good?
It's funny. It's kind of the end of an era. We spent 4 years doing those monthly menus and had so much fun doing it. It's evolving into something new, which is also exciting.
Yeah, I mean, I think evolution, particularly these days in the restaurant business, is really what you have to do.
If you weren't in our business and didn't understand it, you would just think it's so ludicrous.
You would think that you were shooting yourself in the foot.
Right, right. But of course, it's what makes them great. You know, it's being a wonderful innovator is not easy to do, and they're certainly a great example of it.
So when you decided to make this switch, what was it about focusing around wine that became your new organizing principle?
Look, I think wine became such an important part of Maude because of the tastings. And I've always been a big believer in fostering talent. And, you know, we've got such an incredible wine team down there. And they're right there with us. You know, restaurants are usually led by food. And then the wine's sort of there to step it up or you know, like to be beside it. And what we were finding was we'd come up with a dish and then the wine team would present an incredible wine, and the wine would have all of these nuances that the food had. And I'd never worked with a wine team that were able to do that. So when we were sort of sitting down talking about what we loved about Maude and what we wanted to change about Maude, we you know, the thing that I think a lot of us sort of latched onto was how incredible the wine team had done. We'd even got to the place, because it was always, I do the dish, you put the wine next to it. And then we got to the place where we said, bring us a wine that you're interested in and I'll do a dish for it. And, you know, so we reversed that model a little bit and we enjoyed doing that. So travel and wine regions were always something I loved. And, you know, if you're going to work as much as we work in our industry, you may as well try and make it fun for yourself, I reckon.
So let's talk about some of that travel. You and your team recently went to Rioja.
We did.
For a research trip. What really struck you about it? Because I always think that travel for a chef, it's like rekindling love constantly.
It's so true. Justin Hilbert, who was there with us, we had this moment with a guy named Francis, who runs a 2-Michelin-star restaurant. We went foraging with him. And Justin, you know, he's detail-oriented. He's really into his food. I joke with him and tell him he's a little grumpy sometimes. And I literally saw him skip. He got so excited foraging for mushrooms. And, like, he went and he found some wild herbs and stuff that we ended up using in a dish. And he literally skipped back up to us. I said, it's a good day when you just see Justin Hilbert skip across a field. We get so driven by a service in the restaurant business because the guests are coming and you've got to have everything ready. And to get those moments where you can be a child again with your food and really just dream and think blue sky and have those moments, it's really fun. Food is such a personal thing. And, you know, some of the experiences we had there, from an organic winemaker to an incredible 2-star Michelin chef who had such an interesting story. He is almost playing with molecular gastronomy in many ways in his restaurant, Francis, but he comes into his restaurant as a 4th-generation chef owner. So his mum was the chef, his grandma was a chef, and his great-grandma was a chef. All women, by the way. So he's the first male chef in his family to ever take over. And he was talking so passionately about his mum's recipes, very traditional recipes like croquetas. And then, you know, what he's doing is so different and such a departure. And to me, that sort of encapsulates a lot about Spain. You know, there's always tradition, but there's always people breaking through that tradition and doing something really whimsical and fabulous. So, yeah, we really love that. We found some yerba and some different wild herbs that we just came across. And we sort of, when we were talking to Francis about it, I said, why do you do this? You know, it's always fascinating to me. Why do people do the things they do? This guy's got super successful restaurant, and you know he still starts most of his mornings with a basket under his arm and wandering around the mountains, and he said, and as beautiful and romantic and misty and gorgeous as it is, it's still hard work. It's still muddy, and you're still, you know. And I said, why do you do it and not just have someone do it for you? And he said, it's my connection with the mountains. And it's for the spirit of it.
So talk to me about the menu. What is the menu going to look like for this first iteration around Rioja?
So it's very different than what we've been doing. We've probably cut back a little on the number of courses because it was always different menu to menu in the old mode, but we was doing somewhere between 9 and 12 or 13, depends how you count them, I guess. And we've pulled back a little from that. So we're probably looking at more like 7 courses. And I guess that sort of comes from, we found some really beautiful simplicity in Rioja that we're like, you know, isn't it interesting? You sort of, in some ways, less is more, you know, with the style of food that we found. But then others were really playful and really interesting. So we want to sort of keep that alive. We want people to sit down and, I guess in the age-old tradition of tapas, we'll probably start with a few little snacks and then sort of progress through our interpretation of the region, if you will. You know, so while we were there, it was wintertime or late fall, and of course we'll be serving this menu in winter. And we sort of hope that we bring a little bit of a taste of the region to Los Angeles.
So let's talk about L.A. You opened MOD in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
We're now at the beginning of 2018. How much has changed in LA in the last?
So much.
It's crazy, right?
It's a different city from a culinary stance, you know, it's which I love. You know, it's a really good mix of great restaurants that have always been great and great chefs that are still here and still doing an incredible job. But there's a lot of newness here as well now. You know, there's a lot of people from out of town that have come to LA. And I think with, you know, interesting concepts, you ask your guests to go on a journey with you. And you take a risk by doing that. You know, whether that's John and Vinny doing Animal and saying, hey, come eat sweetbreads and foie gras and, you know, stuff that you're not used to seeing on menus. Or if it's Ludo doing a little tasting menu in Tuamek, you know, even what we did at Maud, you know, I think you're asking permission from your guest. Will you let me do something different? And I think, you know, to LA's diners' credit, they've really embraced it, you know, and people quite often say, but isn't LA, and there's all these stereotypes around Los Angeles, is everyone on a diet or does everybody want to customize their dishes? And I've found the total opposite. We've found really adventurous diners here in LA that are willing to go on a journey with you. And I think that that's created even more creativity from the chefs of the city. And with all these new openings and with all these new people coming to LA, they bring good people with them. And then those people stick around because LA is not the worst place in the world to live. And that's great. It's just getting stronger and stronger.
So following Rioja, there'll be 3 more little voyages to other regions
mm-hmm.
that have yet to be announced. Do you want to give us a hint?
We'll be going to France next. And we actually were just there doing that sort of research trip, which was beautiful. Of course, there's so many fabulous wine regions from France. It's hard to keep it balanced in some way. But, you know, the reason we started with Rioja was, to me, it's a really interesting region. The wines are super diverse. There's lots of different grape varietals. And we're trying to explore some of those indigenous grape varietals, not just the obvious ones, not just the Tempranillos. And of course, we'll have good examples of that. And the same with the food. We want to scratch beneath the surface and really try and expose something beautiful. We want to go to the New World too. We want to be in Australia at some point and Argentina or Chile, you know, South Africa. There's so many amazing regions that produce beautiful wine. So, and with good wine always comes good food.
In addition to MOD, of course, you also have your restaurant butcher shop, Gwen, in West Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
So what else is happening in your world this year?
Well, at Gwen, we started with a prefix menu, and we learned quite quickly that it was the wrong thing to do, and what we should be doing is a full a la carte menu. So we've recently changed that. You know, the guests loved coming under the prefix menu, but it didn't feel right, especially for Hollywood. We wanted it to be a bit more vibrant and a bit more fun and give the guests the chance to do whatever they want to do. And we've changed that and things have gone really, really well. So I love my restaurants. I really do. They're like, I was describing them to someone this morning as they asked me which one I preferred. And I said, it's totally impossible to say. You know, they're like your kids. You know, you love them for different reasons and they annoy you for different reasons, but I love being in them. So I'm busy in there right now.
Well, thank you so much. It's always lovely when you come by, Curtis.
Nice to see you, Evan.
That's Curtis Stone. We've been talking about his restaurant, Maud, and its new series of menus inspired by the world's great wine regions. Reservations for the first menu, Rioja, are available now through the end of March. Coming up, a new TV series exploring the seedy underbelly of our food supply chain. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman.
Once you start digging into this industry and this world, you see it's so rich with kind of great characters, great criminals, and then you have cows and pigs running around.
When you lift the veil on the food industry, you can find some pretty shady stuff. Rotten is the name of a new Netflix documentary series about corruption in our food chain. I'm talking with Christine Hawney, who was lead investigator on this series. Rotten brings together the worlds of true crime and food. Trust me, after watching it, you won't look at foods like garlic or cod the same way. Here's a clip from episode one about Big Honey.
More of us are wanting to buy food that we know the source of. The honey industry is perfect for a food-enlightened culture.
But honey is also perfect for savvy profiteers who are secretly cutting the world's honey with cheap substitutes.
The supply cannot meet the demand. Consumers are eating a product that is not honey.
Hi, Christine.
Hi, thank you for having me.
What a great job this must have been for you.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, this was a dream job. I've spent a lot of my time in my career reporting on crime, and, you know, food is kind of the new frontier for criminals right now because it's a great place to make a lot of money, commit a lot of crime, and not serve a lot of prison time.
So do you think, is that where the idea for the show came from? People's fascination with true crime and people's fascination with food, like melding together?
Well, what had happened was I was working at the New York Times in the media desk and was on maternity leave and started watching Anthony Bourdain's Parts Unknown and was just awed by it. And, you know, said to a friend, why am I watching the show? I haven't slept in months. And so a friend at Sever, James Osland, connected me with the heads of Zero Point Zero production. And when I met with them, we talked about, I just suggested the idea of why don't you do something combining food and crime. So they hired me to start investigating this as what we did as a web series. The web series did incredibly well. And then that was purchased by Netflix.
Let's talk a bit about the first episode, Lawyers, Guns, and Honey. For 10 years, we've been hearing about bee colony collapse, which has been put down to a combination of truncated habitat, parasites, and insecticides, and that the death rate of bees year on year can be as much as 50%. And yet we're told our consumption is soaring. Those two facts don't seem to be able to coexist.
Yes, and you're absolutely right. They don't coexist. The bottom line is honey is in everything we consume now, whether it's our bread or our cereal or our cookies, because honey's seen as, you know, the healthier alternative than sugar. In your cough drops, it's better to have a honey cough drop than one with any type of sugar. But at the same time, we in the United States are producing less honey than ever because we have colony collapse, we have declining bee populations. And as you see in the first episode, we also have problems with bee theft. So it's like, how do you reconcile the two? And food manufacturers, food companies are under tremendous pressure to deliver the cookies, the breads, the cakes I want with honey in them. So that's what's created this field and opened up this world of fraud. You have to get the honey from somewhere. So often what you can get can be contaminated. It can be coming from countries with contaminated honey, or it could not be honey at all.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I think at one point there was a statistic that we're consuming four times more than is produced.
Yes, it's extraordinary. It is, and I believe it's growing. So if, you know, you can do everything you can to be a food company that tries to get the best and cleanest honey, but you're also under pressure to get an ingredient for the food that you need to produce.
And I think a lot of people don't think about the quantity that's used in industrial production. Packers, which many of us don't even think about what a honey packer does, they need millions of pounds sometimes for one deal for like a bread company, for example, and they end up blending, right? All these different varieties from India, from Vietnam, from Canada. And then what can go wrong?
Well, what can go wrong is for many years we were getting a lot of honey from China, but the honey from China in some cases was contaminated because they had their own issues with colony collapse disorder there. The reason we're concerned about that contamination is it could be contaminated with things like chloramphenicol, like a dangerous antibiotic. So after the United States passed, you know, regulatory changes that it basically put anti-dumping duties in China, China still found a way to get their honey to the United States. They would just relabel it and kind of ship it through another country. So we are getting our honey from China. It was from Vietnam, but it was actually from China. And so that's how a lot of kind of contaminated honey was getting into our food supply.
It was so fascinating, this particular segment to me. I had heard that honey was being cut with corn syrup, but I guess labs found a way to detect that 10 years ago. So China then just moved on to rice syrup, which is more difficult to detect.
Yes. I mean, the thing about covering honey fraud is that the honey criminals are always kind of 10 steps ahead of us. It kind of reminds me about covering, you know, the collapse of the real estate market and the mortgage industry when I was reporting on that for the Wall Street Journal a decade ago. The criminals were always kind of 10 steps ahead of us, and it's very similar in the honey industry right now. If you come up with a way to detect the way they'll commit the fraud, they'll just, you know, next day wake up and find a new way to do it.
Let's switch from honey to chicken, which is so disturbing on so many levels. It's almost like you don't know where to begin. But perhaps you could just tell us a little bit about this weird system which was set up in which the companies who own the chickens don't really do anything to make them.
Correct. Okay, so basically the way the poultry industry is structured in the U.S. is that there are kind of processors, integrators who, and there are only a handful of them, who really dominate the entire poultry market in the United States. When we looked at for independent poultry producers, we found it's something like less than 1% of all poultry production is independent. So what these companies do, the Tysons, the JBSs, which owns Pilgrim's Pride, you know, the Purdue's, is that they own the chickens and they only farm them out to local farmers to raise them. And then they come back and collect them, process them, and, you know, have them shipped to supermarkets. So the farmers who actually raise the chickens that we put on our plates and have for dinner, they often live at the poverty level or below, and they're subject to a tournament system where they're kind of competing against all the other farmers for based on performance.
And you really managed to capture the heartbreak of these people who work so hard. And in one case, one of the farmers you were focusing on was an immigrant who had made a good life. And then this other bizarre event happened.
Yes. So we feature a gentleman in our chicken episode who was, you know, running his business, running his farm of raising chickens and really loves his chickens. And another farmer who was frustrated and was feeling kind of defeated by the tournament system then had went in and killed all of his chickens in the middle of the night.
It ended up that this gentleman killed all the chickens of several farmers.
Correct. Yes. So there were quite a few farmers in the area who had all had their chickens killed. It was, I think, called like the largest mass murder of chickens that we had known about in history.
Unbelievable. But I think Also, the other part of that segment on chickens that was really shocking to me was the JBS segment, the Brazilian segment, because a lot of us don't really like to fully own how much the decisions and pricing and morality of how things are done happens in countries far away from our own.
Yes, that's a great point. One thing that I loved as a journalist reporting on with the chicken episode is you see how much of what we consume is really playing into this multinational market. Basically, one third of the chicken we consume in the United States is owned by an incredibly corrupt Brazilian multinational company that's run by an incredibly corrupt couple of brothers. And I don't think I'm being extreme when I say incredibly corrupt, because they were involved with the corruption scandal of trying to take down Temer. They have multiple investigations, both in the U.S. and Brazil. They've confessed to like millions upon millions of dollars in bribes. So this is a family who is really kind of in the trenches with white-collar crime and criminal behavior, and they really are responsible for one in three chickens we eat in the United States.
And such a betrayal to the Brazilian people, because they got these sort of nepotistic loans from the Brazilian government that they ended up defaulting on. And so, again, farmers there were hurt, and people who banked with certain bankers were hurt.
You're absolutely right. Yes. So the Batista brothers, who are kind of an endless source of reporting for journalists, really took out a lot of government loans and benefited from a system that then really hurt a lot of Brazilians financially and destabilized, you know, the economies of Brazil with their own kind of corruption and greed.
So we can have really cheap chicken.
So we can have really cheap chicken, but also so they can kind of fill their pockets.
What a series. I can't wait to watch the rest that I haven't seen yet.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I hope you enjoy it.
That's investigative journalist Christine Hawney. The new docuseries Rotten is on Netflix. And now we visit Koreatown for a native dish that's become less intimidating over the years, at least for some Angelenos. It's called gapchang, and contributor Jacqueline Kim has the story.
When Korean barbecue lovers get a craving for grilled beef brisket or pork belly drizzled in salted sesame oil, K-Town never fails. On a Tuesday night, after paying $2 for valet parking, we've come to dine on a very different kind of meat.
My name is Alexandria Yu. I'm the owner of the Pyeolgopchang.
Chang, as in the Korean word for intestine. But before you raise a brow, imagine raising a glass of soju in the air, filled with an aroma of minced garlic, onions, pepper, and a whole lot of sweet pickled side dishes. All the right flavors to complement a chewier bite of meat.
We believe in the natural taste and also the cleanliness of it. You clean it well with flour, soju, and sea salt.
With intestine, there's of course two main cuts to offer. Gopchang, which is the small intestine, and daechang, which is the large. And it's almost always served with another cut, makchang. A bit misleading though, because makchang technically isn't intestine. It's a stomach connected to it. All three are grilled until they're crisp on the outside, then cut into small, popcorn-sized pieces.
I actually do have a couple of customers, more than a couple of customers, who wants to try, but they're afraid to order, thinking that they might not like it.
Not to worry, there's plenty of familiar favorites to choose from, like pork belly, ribeye, the classic pot of steamed egg. Each grill even comes with a side of tater tots. But that won't stop a friend from sneaking in some gopchang on an unsuspecting plate, perhaps calling it calamari.
And then they're like, oh, okay. And then they try, I'd like it. And then he tells them, oh, it's a large intestine or it's a stomach. And they're like, okay, well, it's good.
And if your palate doesn't win you over, chances are the servers will. Like our main server for the night, who simply goes by...
Ju. 여기 있어요, 주. 우리가 최고로 맛있게 이게.
We spend a lot of time training our servers to grill everything in the best way so that customers enjoy a delicious and comfortable meal and want to come back to us. That's our concept, says Chu. A very necessary concept, because grilling gopchang is hard. Undercook it and the innards will be too soft and unsafe to eat. Overcook it and you'll be stuck with charred, crusty tubes. Even veteran grillers will struggle. So the servers here will dance between just two or three tables, watching the grills closely, while you also enjoy...
Oh, it's good. It's like tangy. Spicy, not too spicy, tangy and warm.
Handmade soup이 좀 들어있어요.
Their famous kimchi soup.
매일매일 끓이는데...
We cook our kimchi soup fresh every day, but also add in soft noodle pieces torn by hand. It's been the same for 10 years. When a long-time returning customer visits, they'll say, oh, it tastes just like how I remember it. And that makes us feel really happy. Pyeol Gopchang, translation Star Gopchang, opened 11 years ago after the owner's brother-in-law visited Korea. Gopchang Jeonggeol, the spicy vegetable stewed version of the dish, is more common there. But at a popular beach town in Busan, he saw that grilled gopchang was a hit and asked the owner to help him open up a place just like it in LA.
Actually, when we first opened back in 2006, there was no gopchang place like this. I mean, they had gopchang, but not specialty stores like this. So at that time, we had lines waiting up out the door, like 3-hour waiting.
This is the OG gopchang house.
Yeah. Back then in 2006, mostly like the customers were Korean-based. Nowadays, a lot of the non-Koreans enjoy gopchang and daechang.
But gopchang loyalists know that daechang is the real star of the combo. It's less gamey and a scouted favorite for customers like Gina.
Out of all the places in Koreatown, for sure they have the best daechang here, I think.
Sean at the table across from Gina agrees. He's been coming to Pyeol since it opened over a decade ago.
So usually what I eat when I come here is I order the whole package, but then instead of the makchang, I order the daechang. So I have two orders of daechang and one gopchang. Because, you know, that way you get the best of the daechang, right?
And how many bottles of soju?
As many as they'll give me.
That's because we're eating anju, Korean drinking food. So I ask Sean, what makes him choose gopchang over the rest?
I'm actually in the mood for gopchang like anytime, but the reason I come here so much is because of the great service. The servers are very kind, very generous, and also very friendly, almost like a family life.
Wait, wait, that's not a good answer. Here's a good answer.
Sean's friend Sam weighs in.
The reason why I come and eat gopchang instead of gogi and all that is because, you know, you need some room for your stomach, you know, for soju and stuff. You gotta drink. You know, in order to drink, you have to be light on your stomach. In order to be light, you gotta have gopchang rather than gogi, like beef, to translate that. That's why I came to gopchang, and, you know, I wanted to drink with my friends, so that's why we're here, and I think we should stop the rant.
Whether gogi or gopchang, there's something here for all Korean barbecue lovers. For Good Food on KCRW, I'm Jacqueline Kim.
Our thanks to Jacqueline Kim. This story was made possible by the Independent Producer Project. In a minute, a look at how sound affects the taste of foods like chocolate. That's when Good Food continues.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Valentine's Day is coming up, so we're sharing a timely segment that aired in 2017. Did you ever wonder how sound transforms the taste of chocolate when you pop it in your mouth? Deliciousness seems like it's centered in our noses and on our tongues, but it's actually influenced by so much more. Here's Good Food contributor Simran Sethi. This segment is interactive, so make sure you've got a bar of chocolate close by.
I'd like to take you on a little aural exploration. If you're not driving or walking, go ahead and close your eyes and listen. What do you see? An icy soda? A bowl of chips? Is your mouth starting to water? Probably. That's because sound influences everything, from our breathing and heart rate to expectations about smell and taste. Have you ever heard a sitar playing in your local Indian restaurant? It's designed to make your samosas and vindaloo taste more authentic, says flavor researcher Charles Spence. Sound, he writes in the study Eating with Our Ears, is the forgotten flavor sense. Our sensory experience of food can change up to 60% depending on what we hear while eating and drinking. Throbbing music in a club leads us to down more alcohol at a faster rate, while the din of an airplane dulls our perceptions of sweetness and increases awareness of savory tastes. That's where that hankering for Bloody Mary mix comes from. What we hear as we chew and slurp, or when we tear open a package or twist a bottle, builds our expectations and influences what we ultimately taste. But it doesn't stop there. Sound also impacts our perceptions of texture. In the latest issue of the academic journal Appetite, sound engineer Felipe Carvalho, along with Charles Spence and others, explores this cross-sensory connection.
I am a Brazilian with a touch of Ecuadorian, so I'm Latin American, and I am doing research in Belgium. So I'm doing a PhD in two universities in Belgium. I work as an engineer in the Free University of Brussels and as an experimental psychologist in the University of Leuven.
Felipe has spent his academic career looking at the influences of sound through what he says was most readily available to him in Belgium. That would be beer and chocolate.
Well, it was kind of a coincidence. It was not something that came from a scientific question.
But the depth of smells and tastes in chocolate and beer are perfectly suited to these studies.
It's actually quite strange to think that sound may have a significant influence on the way we perceive tastes and flavors. We don't have this the opportunity to actually reshape the entire tasting experience. But with our research, what we are showing and what we would like to bring awareness is that sound can have an influence. And this influence can be, in some aspects, very significant. It can actually add a lot of value to the tasting experience.
I mean, it's incredible. We think of flavor as being fixed, but it's not.
Yeah, I also find it interesting because it's not obvious. Actually, the starting point of this research comes from the fact that the sensory information is processed by the brain altogether. So we can actually use the information from one sense to influence the perception of the other sense.
That cross-sensory exploration comes together in their latest study, appropriately called Smooth Operator. All right, listeners, get your chocolate ready. What Felipe and his team found is that the taste of chocolate changes depending on the spectrum of music we're listening to.
Somehow, indeed. This is what we have proved in our experiments. What we do is that in our experiments, people, for example, they taste the same chocolate twice without knowing that they're in fact tasting the same chocolate. And each time, the only thing that changes in their experience is the sound.
Let's put this to the test. You're listening to the bitter soundtrack. Are you tasting anything different?
I would say that bitterness in the experiments that we have done so far, and also looking into the scientific literature of my colleagues that also have worked in the same path, we see that bitterness is usually related to lower frequency ranges, to the dissonance, to more complex harmonics composition of instruments, for example, metal family of instruments like trumpets, trombones.
And sweet music is transposed to the other end of the spectrum.
Sweet music, it would be the opposite, exactly. So sweet music would be much more related to higher pitch types of sounds, more consonant harmonics, types of instruments that can be understood perhaps as more pure in terms of harmonic composition, such as pianos and flutes, lots of echo, lots of reverberation, and so on.
Bitter and sweet soundtracks have been developed before, but the musical influence the Smooth Operator researchers created next is unprecedented.
We have decided to move forward and to break this taste barrier and go more into the assessment of flavor attributes. We have shown that sound is also able to change the way you perceive the texture of chocolate.
It's the first ever soundtrack that makes the chocolate in your mouth seem creamier.
Creamy, well, creamy soundtrack is very flute. I can imagine a flute with a very major type of interpretation with a lot of reverberation, major chords with a lot of reverberation and very slow speed, I would say.
This is the new frontier of flavor.
Yes, yes, definitely.
There you have it. The flavor of chocolate and other foods is, well, malleable. Go make it your own. For Good Food, this is Simran Sethi.
That's Simran Sethi. Check out her podcast on all things chocolate called The Slow Melt. And for your Valentine's Day plans, visit the Good Food blog for Simran's article about pairing chocolate with alcohol. That's blogs.kcrw.com/goodfood. Now we turn to another major holiday coming up next week. Friday, February 16th marks the beginning of Lunar New Year in several East Asian cultures. One of them is the Vietnamese celebration of Tet.
You have to have bánh chưng. If you don't make bánh chưng, you got to go buy it, or you're probably going to get gifted, like a few.
That's Deep Tran, chef and owner of Good Girl Dinette in Highland Park. For Deep, celebrating Tet means making something called bánh chưng. They're these labor-intensive bundles of sticky rice, pork, and mung beans wrapped in banana leaves. And yes, they're as delicious as they sound. This week, I had a blast helping her make a batch. She spoke to us about the tradition in 2016. Happy New Year, Deep.
Chúc mừng năm mới, Evan.
So, bánh chưng, are they sort of like rice tamales?
They are, yeah. Instead of corn, it's a glutinous rice, and you cook it long enough where the rice disintegrates and becomes like a masa.
So it's almost like mochi, only you haven't pounded it.
Exactly. You just let the steam, the heat, and time do its thing. So it's a long process because you only soak the rice. You don't cook the rice beforehand. And you put into the package and you bind it. And then you cook it for, like, overnight. You pretty much do a vigil.
Community intensive.
Yes, but very feminine. Like, it's the domestic female realm. There's this card game, Tam Cook. And it turns out that you bust out those cards during Tet because you would have hours and hours of, you would need hours of work to get this done. And then you would also, there would be a lot of, there's intense moments of like wrapping and binding, but there's also like hours of sitting around waiting for the bánh chưng to cook, to finish. And so you would play these cards to pass the time. And it's very specific to Northern Vietnamese women. So
interesting. How old were you when you first got folded into this tradition?
I don't quite remember. So I think forever, you know. As you know, when you're young, you maybe got to wash the rice, you know. Like they didn't trust you with like really important things or dangerous things. And as you get older, you graduate, and maybe. And when you always say you get to, you have to, you must participate, and the duties are correspond to your ability to master. Like wrapping is really hard because to make it really pretty, because it's presentation, you know. So usually it's grandma or like the oldest person who has the nicest hand, like folding technique.
There's you actually took a couple Instagram shots.
Mm-hmm.
And in one of them, you can see that you're putting the banana leaves into a little metal form.
Yeah. That is not... they didn't have sur la table in Vietnam. They might now. Vietnam is changing a lot. A typical bánh chưng is like a 6x6 inch cake by like 3 inch deep.
And, so and how huge. Many people are supposed to eat that?
I don't know. I don't think there's a serving, but it's just like you. That's the size you get. And what you do is you, as a family, you look at it, and it's like looking back at you, and you're like, when are you, like, you have to plan, like, are you ready to eat this? Because we're going to have to cut this. And once you cut it, you quarter it. It's rice, pork belly, and mung beans, all like starchy, dense. Yet very dense. And so then you have three quarters left. And then you'd like, okay, tomorrow I'll smash it up and I'll fry it up. And so you kind of crisp up the edge. So you have this contrast of like that soft masa, mochi interior, and then you have the crunch outside. But if you make it small enough, like the ones I do, which is like 3 by 3 by 1 inch, you can just fry it, pan fry, or like at the restaurant, we just put in the deep fryer. So it gets all the surfaces crunchy.
So it's kind of like leftover grits or polenta, except that you're frying.
Yes.
Except that it's stuffed with this delicious
filling. It
is. Filling.
Yes.
And are there any spices or herbs in it?
I think traditionally you would only do like salt, pepper, nukmam, or fish sauce.
Do you use any kind of table sauce on it?
When you have it just like fresh, it doesn't need anything. It's almost like you want its simplicity. You kind of want to just taste it at its base. When you fry it up, you can actually eat it savory or sweet. Some people love to dunk it in just some granulated sugar, which I find kind of gross. But I like it with like Maggi.
That strange umami-filled sauce.
I love it. Yeah. I'll eat that on anything. So, so you can go sweet or savory on that. We at the restaurant, what we do is we actually top it with our individual banjing with scallions marinated in oil. So you kind of have a little bit of the sweetness of the scallion, but it's really savory.
The banchung you're making at Good Girl Dinette has such a great name.
I was going to name one the typical banchung, and it just seems so like I hate it or something. Like it's not, and I really hate the word traditional because it limits. And
it has a lot of baggage.
It does have a lot of baggage, and it doesn't, and it also is dishonest because every tradition changes. The tradition, like, it expands, it contracts, whatever. So anyway, it's just like, yeah, it wasn't true to what it needed to be. And then I thought, well, what kind of, you know, and I said, this is the matriarch. This is what my grandma would have made. So, and this is the one that my grandma taught me. So we named that
the matriarch.
The matriarch.
How long will you have it in the restaurant?
A month. How long you celebrate that connotes your wealth. If you're like a working stiff, you're like 1 or 2 days, you know, and then you go back to work. But, you know, if you really want to show people how rich you are, then you do a month long.
I cannot wait to put one in my mouth.
I think you're going to like it.
I'm sure, yeah. I'm going to like it. Because every part of it hits my sweet spot. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Evan.
That's Deep Tran. She's chef owner of Good Girl Dinette in Highland Park, where she's now serving banchung through March 6th. So don't delay. To make your own, find a link to Deep's recipe for the matriarch on the Good Food website. After the break, we visit the farmer's market to talk mushrooms. Plus, Jonathan Gold, of course. Don't go anywhere.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Now a visit to the Santa Monica Farmers Market with market correspondent Laura Avery.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. I'm so happy right now to be visiting with executive creative chef Katie Smith from Puesto Restaurant, and that's located down in Irvine. Katie is actually a Chicago transplant. She's out here in LA. She's now overseeing 4 Puesto restaurants in Orange County, San Diego County. You're here at the market today, Katie. Tell us what you're shopping for.
So today I'm shopping for mushrooms. We do a mushroom taco on our menu, and we try and switch up the kinds of mushrooms we use all the time. Every store picks out their own mushrooms depending on what they can get at their local farmers market. And we're going to see what we can find today.
Mushrooms, we used to have sort of a lot of the criminy, the button mushrooms here in California. And because of imports, the smaller mushroom farms have gone away. And yet now there's a resurgence of new mushroom farmers. But they're bringing in stuff like oyster mushrooms, lion's mane mushrooms, different kinds of mushrooms. So tell us the best way to cook a mushroom.
It kind of depends on the mushroom, but I would say my favorite way is to do it in a lot of oil. Mushrooms are really porous. They soak up whatever you put them in and actually get them really crispy. So you do it in a big pan so you don't overcrowd the pan. A lot of fat, olive oil or pork fat is one of my favorites to cook with. Although in the restaurant, we do our vegetarian taco with olive oil and a roasted garlic sauce. So we call it our mojo de ajo. And we just like braise these mushrooms in this garlic sauce and they pick up all of that beautiful, rich garlic flavor.
Okay, when you're doing that, now are you slicing them real thin or putting them in chunks or what?
It depends on what kind of mushrooms we're doing. So we generally use portobellos. We use the big caps as a kind of filler. They go really far. They're really sturdy. And then we try and add something really interesting and exciting. And depending on what that is, so we use a lot of oyster mushrooms. Those are really easy for us to find. And those kind of fall apart really naturally as you cook them. So we don't need to slice those at all. Just maybe pull apart some of the bigger pieces or trim the end of it. But the portobello caps, we absolutely have to slice.
Okay, and when they're soaking up this oil, at one point they look dry, then they start releasing that oil again, and then you kind of figure they're getting done at that point?
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly how you know they're finished, especially with portobellos. When you cook them and you start to see the water sort of start to excrete from it, that's how you know it's pretty much finished.
And when you say you want to get them crispy, are they literally getting crispy?
So not necessarily in the garlic braise that we do, but a lot of times when I cook mushrooms at home, I do a small amount of really nice mushrooms and I get them crispy in oil. So if it's a bigger mushroom, like a trumpet mushroom, I'll cut it in half and score it. Or if they're smaller mushrooms, just pull them into small pieces and then get them really hot in a pan with a lot of fat and just cook them really quickly with some salt and they get nice and crispy. And you get this texture that's almost like bacony, meaty and bacony. I love it.
Okay, and then what else goes into your mushroom taco?
So our mushroom taco is cooked in this mojo de ajo, this like really rich roasted garlic sauce. And then we do our signature dish, which is we wrap our taco fillings in crispy melted cheese. So we've got this flat top grill that we cook on called a plancha, and we melt this Oaxacan queso till it gets really crispy on one side. We fill it with our braised mushrooms and we roll it up. It looks sort of like a cigar almost. Mm-hmm. And so it really encases the flavor and the filling inside. We put that on we make our own homemade blue corn tortillas from a local Macienda factory here in LA called Kernel of Truth. And then on top of it, I put some beautiful microgreens and I make a stone fruit salsa on top.
Oh my gosh. Is this available at all the restaurants? So
absolutely.
We're down in Irvine or San Diego, we can stop on in?
Yep. If you're at our two Irvine locations, our La Jolla or our downtown San Diego location, we've got this mushroom taco on all of our menus.
Mushroom taco. Okay. Sounds so good. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Katie Smith. She's executive creative chef at Puesto Restaurants. There's two in Irvine, one in San Diego and one in La Jolla. The mushroom taco is on the menu all year round. I'm talking now with a mushroom farmer. There are so few of them now who are commercially growing mushrooms in California. Cliff Kane. His farm is located in La Habra Heights, which is adjacent to Orange County, but actually in LA County. And Cliff, you are growing. First, tell us what kinds of mushrooms you grow and how you got into this crazy business.
Sure. Right now, I'm growing three varieties of oysters, a brown oyster, blue oyster, golden Hawaiian oyster, shiitake, and also pia pino and lion's mane. And I got into this business through my family. My father-in-law in Canada has been growing mushrooms since the 1950s. We bought a property in La Habra Heights. We have an avocado orchard. We're 2 miles from the site of the mother tree. And we started doing markets and wanted to expand our farm and have more of a niche, something a little bit more interesting, a little more specialized. And with the help of our folks in Canada, we set up a mushroom growing operation down here.
And a mushroom growing operation is indoors?
Yes. Mushrooms are very particular for their humidity and temperature needs. So they're grown in a grow hut, which is a climate-controlled insulated greenhouse. So we can regulate humidity and temperature We use the appropriate substrate for different varieties of mushrooms, and we recreate the best environment that the mushrooms will be growing in the wild, and we do that indoors.
Does it have to be dark?
Actually, for the mushrooms that we grow are tree mushrooms. They would be growing on a log or a tree trunk in the forest, as opposed to mushrooms that would be growing out of soil. So these mushrooms require some light. So we have lights on timers for these. Larger commercial farms that are growing like button mushrooms, Crimini's, portobellos, those are grown in the dark in beds of soil. Our mushrooms are grown on like little casings of wood and straw, more of a carbon-based substrate that approximates and sort of replicates a tree trunk.
Okay, and you grow, the two that I'm not familiar with are the lion's mane and the pio pino. Let's start with the pio pino. What is that?
Well, the pio pino is an excellent gourmet mushroom, very common in Italy. Apparently, they sell them in supermarkets in Italy, is what I'm finding out from people who are familiar with that. But the pio pino has a beautiful brown, velvety-looking cap. And what's unusual about it is a very long stem. Because of this stem, and it's a low moisture content mushroom, if you prepare it in a pan, like a skillet over a good strong medium to high heat, there's a lot of texture in that stem. The stem becomes crispy. So you get this like charred beef, almost like a charred steak effect with it. And you use the whole stem, so there's no waste with this mushroom. Beautiful mushroom.
Do you leave the cap on when you cook it, and are all parts of the mushroom touching the pan while it cooks?
Oh, yeah. When we cook this, yeah, we leave the whole, sometimes, depending on how long the stem is, we might section the stem, but we use the whole stem, leaving it attached to the cap and just throwing it in a skillet, yeah.
And Cliff, the other one that's so interesting is the lion's mane. Could you describe it first and then explain what it tastes like?
Lion's mane has a texture like crab meat, and when it's been sautéed or roasted, it has a flavor like sweet mild lobster. A very popular in vegan cuisine. If you ever check out some vegan menu, they're doing a vegan crab cakes, vegan California rolls, perhaps a faux lobster. Good chance you're using a lion's mane. Lion's mane also is an incredibly medicinal mushroom. Lion's mane has the unique characteristic of helping nerves and neurons regenerate and heal in the brain. So lion's mane has a reputation for restoring memory loss, for helping with arthritis, for being good for depression. It's been used for a very long time in Chinese medicine.
All right. Well, it's great to have you here. And we are weaning ourselves away from those crimini and the buttons, and we're getting more into the shiitakes and the oysters and the pio pinos now and these lion's manes. So thanks for introducing the new varieties. You're here at the Wednesday Santa Monica. You're at the Saturday Pico Santa Monica. And then you also do Mar Vista on Sunday, right?
That's correct, Laura.
All right. So this is Cliff Kane, and this is Cliff Kane's Mushroom Farm. So check it out. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
And finally, here's our favorite food critic, Jonathan Gold, with a restaurant recommendation. This week, we're going someplace that kind of makes me a bit anxious. Where are we headed today?
We are going to Killer Noodle in the Sautel District.
Uh-oh. This makes me feel like this is the kind of place where you have to specify the number of the hotness you want.
Indeed you do. Actually, two numbers. There's one number for the general hotness, and there's one number for the level of Sancho pepper, which is the numbing thing, not terribly unlike Sichuan peppercorn.
Oh, that's just really scary. So tell me that you didn't have... You did, though. You went for the extreme.
Of course I did.
Right away, or did you go several times?
That was my third visit that I went for the super spicy one. The first one, they actually won't let you go above three.
Really?
Yeah.
Is this one of those places where mild is actually spicy?
No, the mild isn't very spicy at all. I mean, it'd have a little bit of chili in it, but it won't bother you. And my daughter, who is extremely chili averse, was very happy with her level one.
Okay, so we've been talking about the level of spiciness, and we haven't actually talked about the context in which this spiciness is found.
Okay, this is a restaurant from the people who do Tsujita, which is, you know, we've talked about it on the show. It's my favorite ramen place in L.A. It's the best ramen place in L.A. They have the original story. They have a place across the street called the Annex that serves a specific kind of Tokyo ramen that is extremely fatty and has like a big dose of fish, dried fish in with the ramen. This one specializes in tantan men, which is a style that's really popular in Tokyo right now.
So is it noodles without broth?
You have the choice of broth or no broth. Tantan men is of course, based on the Sichuan dandan mian, which is the most popular sort of noodle in Chengdu or Chongqing.
So is it sesame-based?
There is sesame. There is peanut butter in at least one of the versions. There are pickled vegetables. I mean, this isn't the kind of Japanese cuisine that's noted for its subtlety, you know, where you look for the droop of a pine needle or the fragrance of a single cherry blossom. I mean, this is powerful stuff.
This is slurping.
Yeah. And there's essentially, there's three dishes on the menu, but, you know, one of them is the Tokyo style. There's another style that has a little bit of vinegar in it and is a little bit sweeter. They say it's closer to the Sichuan one, which it might be. And then there's a third that they call original style, which has a lot of tofu in it and is flavored with black pepper instead of chili.
That sounds good because the tofu would temper the spiciness a bit.
Yeah. If you are somebody who delights in eating the super spicy foods of Los Angeles, like the dynamite at Jit La Da or the highest level at, what is it, Impact 2 at Orochan or, you know, whatever they're selling at, or Guisados, you know, that.
The Chiles Torreados.
The Chiles Torreados. The last time I had Chiles Torreados was the time that I had to finish it because I felt obligated to. And then I tore next door to the ice cream store and said, oh, what flavor would you like to taste? I want ice cream. What flavor would you like? I don't care.
So this is the kind of dish that you will appreciate if you appreciate those other experiences.
It's not nearly as hot as those.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, I mean, it's not so hot that the flavor is obliterated. It's a nice flavor. If you have a 5 or a 6, you will definitely notice it. But it's just sort of half endorphin high and half maybe a buzzy numbing, maybe feeling like Sigourney Weaver right before the alien bursts out of her stomach. I don't know. They actually have a list of rules there, and one of them is take care of your bottom.
That's really scary. I can't even follow that. Thank you, Jonathan.
Glad to be here, Evan.
That's it for this week's show. If you missed any part of it, you can listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app, or you can find us on Apple Podcasts. Many thanks to the Good Food team, Nick Liao, Rosalie Atkinson, Laurel Garcia, Joseph Stone, Joel Stein, and Ronnie Mickelson. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.